Well, Think Local First, a business membership organization of Santa Cruz County, California, is conducting an Eat Local First festival to celebrate local farmers, processors, restaurateurs, and foodies. This effort leads us to ask, why eat local first?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 939th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in way down there in Port Stanley, there in the Falkland Islands, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metroform.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels back in the studio. Dave, you there?
Glad to be here.
Thanks for being there today. Also with us today, we have producer Kelly Bayer. Say hello, Kelly.
Hello, everybody.
Well, folks, charity begins at home is a principle accepted by people of all beliefs and cultures throughout recorded time. The principle asserts in the simplest of terms that we should take care of ourselves, our families, and our communities first. By first taking care of ourselves, the principle suggests we can then develop the strength and resources to reach outside of ourselves to help others. Our nation, the United States of America, did indeed help itself first and then proceeded to go about the world helping others develop. But as we focused on helping others, many of our own communities have fallen into disrepair and now resemble the poorer communities of the world that we're trying to help. And in spite of the millions and billions and trillions of dollars we pour into these domestic communities by our federal government, those communities just seem to keep getting poorer. This decline leads us to ask, who will resurrect dying communities if not the community members themselves? What better way to rescue dying communities than by thinking local first? And what better way to think local first than by eating local first? Today we are going in search of answers to the inaugural Eat Local First Festival, the Monterey Bay Certified Farmers Markets in Aptos, California. This market has just been named California's best and America's second best by Farmland Trust, so it'd be really difficult to get a closer to the heart of the America's local food movement than we are here today. The Eat Local First Festival is being sponsored by Think Local First. I'm a proud board member of Think Local First, and I hereby give up all pretense of journalistic objectivity today. That being said, let's meet the founders of Think Local First and see what they have in mind by directing our thoughts in such a manner. Peter Beckman, let's start with you.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to have you aboard here.
It's a wonderful event. It's just pretty amazing. And the most quintessential way to think local is have our local food close to where we are.
There we are. So a little bit about your background before we go to Carl.
I am from Germany. I am a baker and started a bakery, local bakery in Santa Cruz, almost 30 years ago now, which has grown to a good local food source for everybody. We do organic breads, looking into, of course, gluten-free now also. The whole sourdough range for California, and we our delivery range is San Francisco to Big Sur.
So that's pretty local food there.
Yeah, it's very local.
Also with us today, Carl Hyman, where your Cafe Bergolesi, and Mr. Toots, you're a restaurateur.
Yeah. Hello, Michael, and hello, everyone out there. I don't know if Michael mentioned this is live from Aptos, California. So come on down, be on the radio, eat some great food.
Even if you're in Florida, you can come down to Aptos, California, and get in on the fun. And, you know, I guess that's the fun thing about being here at the farmer's market, because this farmer's market is part of a huge trend in the United States of local food, and the best place to get in touch with local food wherever you happen to be is at your farmer's market. We happen to be at California's best farmer's market, which is a lot of fun today. Let me ask. Oh, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say what we're doing here today is we are part of this farmer's market, and we have a festival called Eat Local First Food Festival. And there's about 20 local restaurants and food suppliers here sampling free stuff. And what a great opportunity to come and test out these restaurants' foods, cookies, candies, ice cream, all for free at a great farmer's market. So
take us to Think Local First. I mean, you gentlemen came to me about 5 years ago, I guess it was, and said, let's... 7 years ago, my, how time flies. Jeez. So what exactly is Think Local First? Carl?
Well, it's all about supporting your local community by thinking about purchasing goods locally first. I know most people, including myself, when you go out and shop, you look for the best deal. But what Think Local First is all about is just say, hey, can I get it locally first? If not, fine. If you can, great. And if you can, it helps the local economy. The money goes right back into the local community as opposed to buying in a big box store where you spend your money and it goes to their corporate headquarters. So all we are saying is an organization that if you go out and go shopping, just think about buying it locally first. There's a lot of good local stores and restaurants right here in Santa Cruz County, so just think local first.
Or wherever your community happens to be around the United States. It's look to building your own community first. Peter, how did you come up with this notion? And why did you come up with this notion?
Well, I was sitting down with some fellow business friends 8 years ago, and we were talking about how we like our community and how we would like to keep it that way. Because looking around in the world, in America, we see many towns getting destroyed, basically, and looking the same in like big shopping malls, all have the same corporate stores. And we just didn't want this to this wave to come to our town. So we sat down with some other business people and took us a year to hammer out some bylaws and start our first meeting. And we started a very successful movement to promote our local business community and also local community, because again, as Carl and Michael already mentioned, the money you spend at local businesses goes around and comes to back your local parks, your kindergartens, your firefighters. It's there to stay in the community. So even if you spend a little less sometimes at corporate stores, it's not, this is the money that goes away. And what you spend more at local stores, it's really a dividend you get back later by feeding our local communities here.
And we've done some interesting experiments to demonstrate the efficacy of that notion. We started off once with $500 checks, and we passed them around the community for 30 days, and those $500 checks turned into about $9,000 worth of business. So shopping local really has a way of compounding money, not just spreading it around, but it really compounds itself when you shop local instead of going out of town. Well, let me ask both of you this question. I was just down at Costco, which has become an almighty retailer across the country, and they have this new marketing positioning statement that says, think Costco first.
I wonder where they got that.
But so how do you compete with somebody like Costco, who is so good at competing? How can a local community, how can local business compete?
Well, in my mind, Michael, this is Carl again, the way to do that is that the local businesses know the local people. You go into your local store and you know the owner, you know the person who's bagging your stuff, you know the person who's serving you. When you go to Costco or when you go to Home Depot, it's aisle after aisle of these massive racks, and you don't know anybody there. There's no community feeling. You don't really know the people there. But, you know, when I go to Shopper's Corner, I know the baggers. I know the people that own it. When I go to Penny Ice Cream, I know the people. It's more about community, you know, knowing your local business owner, and they know you. You know, to me, that's what it's all about.
And the way to compete, really, against the big guys is to promote your local strength as a local business. One of the things that always comes to my mind is accountability. If you buy something at a locally owned store, you know the store owner will be there 5 years from now. If something goes wrong with the thing you buy, you go back there and you talk to him. So he knows that, and there is some bigger accountability than in chain stores where 5 years from now, there's nobody there you ever talk to, and of course the warranty has expired and there you are.
You know? So the community stays here. Well, that's a couple of good members of Think Local First, founding members, Peter Beckman from Beckman's Bakery, Carl Hyman from Cafe Pergolesi, and Mr. Toots in Santa Cruz, California. That's where we're at today. One of the most wonderful places in the world, because I happen to live here. And you're invited to stay with us, because we're going to meet Catherine Barr, who is the manager of America's Second Best Farmers Market, and we're going to ask her why eat local first. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson live from a farmers market. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. Michael Olson here. Where? Well, we're at the Certified Farmers Market, Monterey Bay Certified Farmers Market in Aptos, California. Just named California's best market and America's second best market. Catherine Barr, market manager. Why only second best?
You stinker. Well, we were competing against all 50 states. So, you know what? I don't think that's too bad. But it gives us something to strive for next year.
Isn't that great, though, that you missed it and you can still get it, but you have to strive harder to make it?
And we'll do that. We will do that for our customers.
So, you know, what on earth makes a market so popular and so vital?
I think you really have to start with those farmers, because that's what really brings the crowd.
Well, wait a minute. Which is most important, the farmer or the a consumer?
It's kind of like the chicken and the egg.
Chicken and egg, yeah.
Well, you know, I guess, you have to have something for customers to come for. So, you know.
Right.
And a lot of our customers have been here for as long as we've been here.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do have that rapport with that person growing their food.
I always think of myself as a farmer, because I patronize the farmers at the farmers market. And not only do I patronize it, but I encourage everybody else to as well. And in doing that, I kind of become like a farmer, because I select things,
mm-hmm.
and I tell them what I want,
right.
and what is important to me. And in doing that, you know, you kind of become an owner in the market.
You do. You become an owner of that farm.
Yeah.
You know, it's really nice to see that relationship between consumer and that person growing your food. And I've seen it for years and years, and it's really kind of nice. Again, a win-win situation for everyone.
So you have how many farmers at this market?
I have 65 farmers at this Aptos market, mm-hmm. and that's during
and peak time. Aptos is not a big town.
No, it's not. No, but you know, we get a lot of people from Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. The Watsonville area. We have some who come over the hill because they lived here and they've moved away, and this is their market. This is their community market, so they'll come back every Saturday morning just to see us.
And we'll talk a little bit about the notion of markets around the country, because I know even in my hometown of Billings, Montana, the farmers market essentially has taken over the downtown,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
nobody was really using.
Right.
You know, and when it gets right down to it, downtowns have become kind of derelict places.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And farmers markets across the land are really bringing people back into cities.
You're right. You know, I mean, we're on a parking garage, for goodness
yeah,
sakes.
For
you
goodness
know,
sakes.
I mean, you know, community college, which is really nice, and that's a good thing. Community.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does bring people back to the land. It does bring them back together. I mean, maybe I'm dating myself, but I see people here that I went to fourth grade with. You know, so again, you have that sense of community at a farmer's market anywhere.
To what extent do you think can a community grow to feed itself? I mean, I guess the question is, how far can this whole notion of local food be taken?
Oh, I think it's unlimited. Basically, I think the sky's the limit on this. That's kind of
well,
a hard question.
Well, you're kind of in on the your market here is, you know, a very early market.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah,
and so you've been developing it. So you've seen the progress.
We have. And, you know, I think with this organization, it's still run by farmers. You know, that's who's mm-hmm. on the board. And that's what we're all about, is that certified farmer. You know, a lot of some of the other farmers markets everywhere, you know, they have a lot of food purveyors, which is really nice.
Right.
They have crafts and so forth. But that's not what we're about. We're about the land.
I see some crafts here.
Yeah, he's a grandfather. What can I say? But I mean, I think it's, you know, we want people to really talk to that person growing the food and take that stuff home and cook it. You know, I mean, that's, you know, it's better than just the processed stuff that you can get,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think you're really helping out not only the farmer, but I think you're helping out yourself and your family.
So that's really something significant for people who want to see the growth of local food, is mm-hmm. that they should really focus on making that connection with farmers.
Oh, absolutely.
So if you're just making a connection with somebody who bought at a wholesale market and
yeah.
put up a truck next to the, it's really not developing local agriculture or local food.
And that relationship. Yeah, I agree.
So now the big question, do you see yourself as becoming a threat to an industrial food system?
Such as like grocery stores and things like that?
Yeah.
Is that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we are really a threat. I think, you know, it would be really nice if grocery stores were able to buy local from our farmers. You know, again, mm-hmm. that would be a great thing. Some of these farmers are really struggling. I mean, you look at this and we are thriving. You know, we have a lot of people out at the market, but you know, some of these farmers are really hurting. And you know, wherever we can go ahead and help them, I think it'd be great. And I think it'd be really nice if these, you know, big like Safeways and Albertsons mm-hmm. and et cetera, were to buy from
I saw a sign hanging from Walmart.
Uh-huh.
It said local food.
Oh, yes, yeah. Did you see where the local food came from?
Bangladesh.
I guess their rendition of local food or their explanation of local food and ours is a little different.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about how this kind of activity builds community. You know, we look across the country and we see some of our prized communities are falling into disrepair.
Right.
You know, Detroit, Chicago.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I mean, there's some real serious basket case cities here. Do you think that local food and thinking local first can bring communities back to places that have lost them?
You know, I really think they can. You know, there's a movement here, even in just Watsonville, where they're taking a lot of the empty lots. You know, and this is from the earthquake in 1989
yeah.
that nothing was ever built back up there. They're taking these lots and making them into community gardens, you know, so they are feeding their own little communities within the community, which I think is just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
We donated a bunch of fruit trees to one of their projects, and it's just like, I think that's great because they were able to go out to the farmer, you know, and ask about what fruit trees would be best in this particular area. And I like to see that. And I think, you know, Detroit and all those, Chicago and so forth, would be really helped if they had something like that going on.
You know, the interesting thing about a community garden is I sit on the board of a local community garden here. And what you see in a community garden is people sharing spaces, essentially.
Yeah.
But well, beyond that, you know, one person grows one thing and his next door neighbor grows another thing, and they look at each other and the first thing they do is say, how do you do that? And then they start trading.
Yep.
Trading food back and forth.
Right.
And in that process, that is an elemental working of a community.
Yes.
It's how you
yeah.
start building things and things start growing. And pretty soon you have a situation where, like we have today, where we have this wonderful farmers market where people are wandering around, big smiles. I've never come to the farmers market without seeing smiles on people's
faces. Isn't that nice? Isn't that great? That's a good way to start your day. It really is. And
what is it about farmers market that makes people smile?
Well, I think they generally want to be here because we are kind of in the out of way place. I mean, if you really look at it,
you have to
make an effort to be here. Again, I think it has a lot to do with our farmers because they're smart. I mean, this is their social time as well. You know, a lot of them have been stuck on their farm all week, and Saturday morning comes, and guess what? They're going to go look and see their friends, and I think that's great.
So, looking across the country, what advice would you give people who would like to build this kind of community market in their town? Where do they start?
Where do they start? Oh my gosh, from the ground up, of course.
Uh-huh.
I think you really need to get a group of people together, such as, you know, other food purveyors, farmers, some of the local, you know, politicians. You know, come together, come with a plan. And just start it. You know, this is what this group did, you know, 30-some-odd years ago.
My notion is the best way to start it is take your money out of your wallet and say, I want local food. And it will come.
Yeah, it will come. Yeah. If they build it, they will come. You're right.
Catherine Barr, manager of the Certified Farmers Markets of the Monterey Bay Area. This one here at Aptos, California, named California's best, America's second best. Now, good luck next year.
Oh, you better believe it.
All right, got it. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks.
Welcome back. Michael Olson here. We're at a farmer's market in Aptos, California. Certified farmer's market, and it is the California's best farmer's market, named that by Farmland Trust, and also America's second best. Got work to do here at the market. But I think, you know, given the look on everybody's face today, I think they're well on their way. Because there are lots of happy, smiling faces here today, in spite of a little bit inclement weather. We have some fog here in California. It makes it nice and cool. Keeps the arugula fresh, right, Chef Jamie Smith?
It does. It does. It loves that cool fall weather.
So, Chef Jamie, last time you were on the food chain with me, we talked food for school children. You've since migrated into your own world. Got your own line of food, really interesting food that you're going to be selling directly to people so they don't have to eat bad food.
There's a lot of bad food out there.
There's a lot of bad. Well, what makes food bad?
I think a lot of people have debated that. I think Michael Pollan probably says it best. You know, if you read the ingredient label and there's things on there you don't know what it is, you know, it's probably not food.
And know what it is and you can't pronounce it, then stay away.
I like what he calls it. He calls it food-like substances. So if you're eating things that qualify as food-like substances, it's probably not the best food you can put on your plate.
Well, Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food, really seems to, you know, that bad food kind of fits into that.
That's very true.
Because the farther you get from the source of your food, the more they have to put food-like substances in it to hold it together. Otherwise, it decomposes pretty rapidly. But we're in a place where we don't have to worry about that, and it's a local food place. So, Chef Jamie Smith, why eat local first?
Well, I mean, there's so many reasons that I think are on display right here in front of us at the farmer's market. But I think, you know, the best one is what you just said. When you eat local, you are eating fresh and what's in season, and that is going to be some of the healthiest food and the best tasting food you can get your hands on. You don't have to have additives to make food taste good when you eat local and fresh. You know, eating seasonally is the way humans were meant to eat. We were meant to eat what's growing around us before technology got its hands on it. I think a while ago, Michael, you told me something that I kind of hadn't really thought about, but food technology is basically the technology that allowed us to do almost everything else, like broadcast live from a farmer's market, to have an iPhone or, you know, all these other pieces of things that we call technology now. And, you know, food technology and preservation was the thing that pretty much allowed us to do that, because before that, we were basically subsistence. it is healthier for sure, but also there's just a, it's a great thing. It's a great feeling to have a connection to your food, to know the farmers that grew your food, and to get to know the artisans and the craftsmen, the people that make the food for you. So I think that there's something that's very rewarding about that, and you can see it on display right here at the market.
Well, do you think the converse could be true as well? Do you think that losing touch with your food or going so far away from your food that you really no longer know what's in it or where it came from or who had anything to do with it, do you think that has a deleterious effect on community? I mean, when you no longer have that touch?
I think it does for sure. I think the scariest thing about that is...
I'm thinking about, like, Detroit, you know. What happens to some of America's great cities? It just seems like, and you go into those cities, they're like food deserts.
Yeah, they are. Well, there's food-like substances everywhere, and you can see the wrappers for them laying in the street. I think it has a really negative effect, and I think the scariest thing is when people actually don't care, when they'll actually buy the stuff, the junk food, look at the ingredient label, see, you know, 15 different chemical agents in there that they don't know, and still eat it. I think that's a scary thing. And, you know, losing the connection to food is, you know, going to have a huge negative effect, I think, on the next generation. And I don't think it's just in Detroit. You know, when I was here, when I was working for the schools, sometimes I'd take field trips to little fast food marts around our high schools and watch the kids line up and buy, you know, the cup of soup and the Arizona iced tea and just basically salty, sweet, yucky junk food and not even care. And I would talk to them afterward. Well, I know I should eat healthier, but it doesn't taste good. And I'm like, well, what did you have? Well, I don't know. I just heard it doesn't taste good. You know, they're not even willing to try anymore. So when it doesn't happen at home, it's not going to happen when the kids are...
Oh, there we go. So how important are parents in this?
I think they're really important.
Consideration.
I think that, you know, kids exert a lot of pressure on parents. You know, I want, you know, buy these Pop-Tarts for me, and you finally just throw in the towel. I mean, I think 80% of parents admit that they have bought something that they knew they didn't want to buy for their kids because kids put pressure on them to buy it. So, you know, I think parents have to be, you know, staunch in their advocacy for eating healthy food, and they have to be able to do it at home. And so, you know, I think a lot of people don't have time to cook, so that's why I'm doing what I do now, making healthy meals that are ready for folks to take home and heat up themselves. But I think, you know, a lot of people are actually just lazy. I think there's just a little too much going on in our lives now. Well, I think there's too much.
Here's a place where the farmer's market,
yeah.
You know, the place is becoming increasingly crowded. It's almost like you can't see 10 feet now because of the number of people.
It's
and
great.
You see a lot of children.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a great place to start that advocacy, if you will. So, I mean, you know, when we live in cities, we're way far away from people like Sandra here who grows our food. And so we grow farther and farther away. But you look at the kids here, and they're following their parents around, and they're chewing on this, and they're chewing on that. And everybody's got big smiles. Maybe this is how we could teach our children, you know, how we can compete with television, with everything else.
Yeah. I think I heard that a child that watches the average amount of television, which I think is like an hour a day, which is already pretty scary, in 1 year they will see 4,600 advertisements directed at them, at children, about processed prepared foods. So almost 5,000 commercials an average child will see for, you know, Shrek Twinkies and Pop-Tarts and Fruit Loops and
Eggo waffles,
and Coca-Cola and stuff like that. So
I was watching an Eggo waffle commercial last night. It had nothing to do with food.
No.
And it had nothing
cartoon
to do with
characters and Dora and Shrek and movie characters. And
so let me ask you, Chef Jamie Smith, to what extent can eating local first, how far can we take this? How far can eating local be taken?
Well, I mean, I think it can happen in any community. A lot of people say that there are food deserts everywhere. You know, I kind of disagree, and I see it popping up even in, you know, in sort of more blighted areas of our city. You know, here in Santa Cruz, in Beach Flats, you see these produce trucks just pull off on the side of the road, open up the back, and they're selling fresh produce, and everybody from the community is coming in there. I think there's opportunity everywhere. And even if you talk about a city like Detroit, you know, remember the old scratch and sniff book for Christmas where you, you know, the little boy would, you know, you'd flip a page and you'd scratch and it would be the smells of Christmas, like
right,
a candy
right.
cane. And there was the one with the orange that he gets in his stocking. Remember, the orange in a stocking was like this amazing thing a long time ago. That was before
because
technology.
It was an amazing thing to right. have an orange in a stocking
and
in
so
the winter.
So now we have this, yeah, but we have this expectation that you should be able to have tomatoes in January, that you should be able to have oranges in Minnesota all the time. But that wasn't how it used to be. You know, we used to eat what was in season. We used to be able to can and preserve. And so, you know, these food artisans are popping up all over the country where people are making jams and jellies and preserving and canning. And, you know, small bakeries are really taking
and
off again.
Eat local first.
Yeah, eat
Chef
local
Jamie
first.
Smith, thank you for joining us this
My
morning.
Pleasure.
All right, we'll do more later. Stay tuned, folks, for more Eat Local First at the Think Local First, Eat Local First on Food Chain Radio. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, today we're taking you to a farmer's market. Not just any farmer's market, but California's best farmer's market, America's second best. Here in Aptos, California, it is a certified farmer's market, which means the farmers you meet here who are selling you the food are the farmers who actually grew the food. And right now I'm going to introduce you with one of my heroes. Hero because his family brought raw milk to the farmer's market, and I got to have raw milk in my life again, Bo Schlock. So,
hi.
Welcome, and thank you, by the way.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So, I have become a great fan of your raw milk. So, it wasn't easy bringing raw milk to the farmer's market.
No, not necessarily easy. For one thing, it's heavy.
It's heavy, yeah.
It's a lot of...
It's not like carrying lettuce around,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, right. A lot of slopping around heavy bottles of milk. But yeah, I think you're referring to maybe some of the regulatory pressures.
Well, you know, in looking at the contentious issue of raw milk seems to be a very threatening thing to the conventional food distribution system. They seem to be very frightened of raw milk for some reason. I say that because of the amount of grief a lot of local farmers go through when they try to sell a gallon of milk to their neighbor. You look across the country and some of these people are getting thrown in jail for selling raw milk.
And yeah, you hear some pretty crazy stories out there. You know, it is pretty wild. You know, California is one of the few states that raw milk is allowed at the retail level. But there's only three dairies right now, I believe, in California legally able to sell raw milk, us being one of them.
Why is that?
It's it really comes down to the quality standards. There's a lot of testing. You know, obviously, I think with anything raw, there's some liability associated with it. And, you know, because there is a risk in anything you do. I mean, even crossing the street, there's a risk. And
there's a risk right now in eating chicken.
Yeah, exactly. The salmonella.
Yeah, yeah, look out.
So it is allowed to sell raw milk, but we, you know, you have to do a lot of testing. And you pay for it, you know, with the state regulators. But the quality standards are very stringent, and the quality standards is what makes it very difficult for a lot of dairies to be able to meet those thresholds.
Well, you know, raw milk is so different than what you find at pasteurized milk. I mean, to me, when I take a bottle of your milk home, it's almost like I can drink it out of a shot glass. It's like sipping whiskey or something. It's so incredibly rich and precious that a little bit goes a long, long ways. So how do you go about keeping my milk safe, and me too?
Well, you know, it really starts in the milk barn. And, you know, and we're an old dairy. You know, our little dairy's been, you know, in operation since 1944. And, you know, it's an older milk barn. And, you know, it's not state-of-the-art, but really where the quality starts is the actual milker, the man putting his hands on the cow and putting the...
And who's that in your family?
And that's my father.
That's so, Dad, right?
That's Dad. He knows every cow, and that's really where we get those really high quality standards of the milk, you know, the low bacteria count. And then, but to take that one step further, my brother Ty, he's usually here today. I'm usually making cheese today. But he does all the bottling. So my brother does all the bottling, you know, make sure everything is pre-sanitized. And we actually test every batch of milk. And then when we're coming to the farmer's market, we're bringing...
How do you test it?
You know, simple Petri dishes. So think old school biology classes, you know, milk on a Petri dish and you, you know, incubate it. And then you count the colonies. And but anyways, it's, you know, it's not terribly complicated, but it's just an added layer of protection. And that's some of the things you just need to do to be smart about selling anything raw, I think, is...
Sure.
Yeah, you know, even being a small family farmstead, I think you need to do a little bit of testing, especially in today's
raw milk is living milk. I mean, it has life in it, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, that's one of the interesting things about raw milk, you know, doesn't necessarily putrefy. You know, it can sour, but it doesn't necessarily putrefy because it is full of that living lactic acid bacteria and it naturally starts to ferment. But yeah, it's a living food. It's got good enzymes in there and lactic acid bacteria, you know, probiotics and these things that we're starting to find are good for you and maybe our great grandparents already knew about.
Well, I certainly did.
I've been drinking raw milk since I was about 1 year old. You know, that's all I was ever, you know, gave as a child. So I grew up, I didn't know anything any better. You know, my dad just literally brought home milk in a Tupperware and you just knew you had to shake it or stir it with a fork to, you know, to stir in the cream before you drank it. And that was just life.
I think that's what I remember so much about my youth is milking. Now, do you still milk by hand?
No. Very few dairies. It's milking by hand is a lot of work. Now, even with machines, though, it's a lot of hand work because you're still prepping the cow. So you wash the cows. You're actually you do like a, we call a teat dip. So you kind of like somewhat like sanitize the actual
disinfect,
teat. And then you actually what you do, especially with the raw milk and bottling, is you always prime the cow, which means the first couple squirts you kind of take the first couple squirts out of the teat canal to kind of clear the milk, and then you actually put the machine on. So there's actually a lot of hand work before you put that machine on to kind of make sure it's a nice clean udder.
Well, doggone, we're out of time, but I just want to say thank you for bringing the milk to the market.
No,
because
problem.
It's really enriched my life. I love the milk and I love taking it home. Ice cold. I love pouring that first glass of ice cold raw milk and just sitting back. Whoa, too much fun. Thank you so much.
Appreciate
and
it.
This is the Food Chain. Right back with more. Do stay tuned. So much to talk about, so little time to talk about it in, but we're going to try it anyway. We're here live today at the Monterey Bay Certified Farmers Markets in Aptos, California. We're talking about the whole notion of thinking local first and starting with that process of thinking local first by eating local first. And so we're having an Eat Local First festival. We're bringing together the farmers, local farmers. We're bringing together local food processors. We're bringing local restaurants. We're bringing foodies together, and there are lots of foodies here. Right now we've got Guy Chanda, and Guy is the owner of Vita Oliva. So you're a food processor, right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, I just got to pull that microphone up here because there's a lot of racket we're competing with.
Yeah, that's correct, yes.
So how long have you been in the olive oil processing business?
We've been in olive oil for about 10 years now.
10 years?
10 years, yeah. Most of it, we sell a lot of product in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife is from Spain. And I grew up pretty locally around here, Cupertino, Santa Cruz.
So you're a local boy, met a Spanish girl, and fell in love with olive oil.
That's basically it, yes.
Good enough. And now you're in the business of processing those olives into oil and bringing them to United. So tell me about olive oil. I mean, for a Montana boy, you know, there wasn't a lot of olives.
That's a pretty big question.
Yeah.
So, olive oil has a lot of benefits, we know. You can start with the heart, skin, with a lot of things we focus
on. It's like the foundation of the Mediterranean diet, right?
It really is. And so, like in our family, we never see butter. I haven't seen butter in 20 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's really.
I've never been a butter person. So, olive oil is really good for heart health. The lactic acid content is really important. You have natural antioxidants, so, and the skin as well for anti-inflammatories. So it's good to actually try olive oil in the morning. In Spain, they call it ayunas, where it means before you have breakfast, you take a shot of olive oil.
So is that the difference? I just did an interview with a gal who wrote a book about Julia Child, and she was, of course, the authority on French cooking. And somebody said that Julia Child is really like Che Guevara with a saute pan and a pound of butter. And I got to thinking, that really is the difference between French cooking and Italian cooking, isn't
and
it?
Spanish as well.
And Spanish as well, yes.
Yeah, Spanish would be the olive, and French is more buttery. Absolutely, yeah.
And therein lies the difference between those.
There's a huge difference. Yeah. But France is changing. France is actually, and Italians are the biggest buyers of Spanish olive oils now.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's changing. The Mediterranean diet is actually going north.
Going north? But I'll tell you, I'd have a tough time with that because I'm, you know, Montana boy, Viking,
yeah, I'm
you know,
sure
I'm a Viking, and Vikings are. But we're learning to all about olive oil too, and I just had a taste of some of yours, and they're just really exquisite. But aren't they both, you know, butter and olive oil? Aren't they both exquisite when done correctly? You know, when you have
if they're done correctly, yes, yeah. Absolutely. I think most products are that
like
way,
the,
though, right?
It's like the milk guy we were just talking to. Oh my goodness, the milk is so different than the stuff you get at the store. There's no comparison.
That's with any product, though, right? I think most products, whatever it is, if you treat it with respect, it's going to be a good product. And whether it's butter or olive oil, it'll be a good product.
And when you're looking at the farmer and looking into his eye and seeing, how did you go about growing this?
Yeah, you know, and most people here in Santa Cruz, we live in an exceptional place because most people really understand quality food. Food is really important here.
I think every place in the world is going to be like this place soon.
So.
Guy Chandra, Vita Oliva, thank you so much. And
thank you, Michael.
Boy, I think we're out of time. Dave, thank you for being an engineer today. And thank you all for tuning in out there. Remember, cheap food isn't. See you next week.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.